warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time, and we shall be discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Just before I introduce my guest today, I'd like to mention, as usual, that this program is being recorded on Zoom. So if you do hear a few noises off, you'll understand why. So helping us in our explorations today is Dr. Keith Buhajar. Dr. Buhajar is a visiting senior lecturer at the Department of Classics and Archaeology at the University of Malta. And looking at his bio, I think the best word to use to describe him is hydroarchaeologist. I don't know whether he'll agree with my definition of his field of study. In fact, his book, which was published following his doctoral thesis, is entitled Malta and Water, AD 900 to 1900. So welcome and thank you, Dr. Buhajar, for accepting to come on the program to talk to us about hydrology and its importance within the field of archaeology. So,
Thank you for hosting me on this program.
Our pleasure. So, Keith, if I may. Keith,
yes, of course.
Perhaps we could start off by looking at a definition of hydrology in general and really what it means to you with regard to the water study that you do. So we can start to understand and visualize a little bit its meaning.
Well, of course, basically speaking, a basic definition for hydrology would consist of looking at the distribution of water, both above the surface and also subsurface, at the geology where it might be located. And as a matter of fact, it basically relies and implies water availability as a resource.
Well, I imagine that within that context, it's sort of landscapes and their geology are obviously important aspects of the kind of hydrological study that you do.
Of course, practically speaking, when I'm out in the field, both abroad and locally, my mind is always wondering, it's trying to grasp an understanding of the geology that I'm dealing with in order to enable me to get a better idea of the hydrology and that is of the water that would lie within the landscape. Having water at the surface is quite the easier aspect of my practice. The most challenging one is to actually try to detect subsurface water deposits, which both historically and archaeologically would have actually enabled the formation of a settlement that would be found within that context. The idea is that more commonly than not, a settlement in its location would be basically there for a number of reasons. One of the principal reasons would be water availability.
The geology, we are very familiar with the Maltese geology. When we go around the island, you can practically see it lying there in layers. But what are the geological situations elsewhere that have a deep effect on the hydrology, well, both surface and below ground? What are the geological parameters that permit one thing perhaps and perhaps don't permit another regarding underground water or rivers?
So first and foremost, one of the most important thing when it comes to understanding hydrology from an outside, a context that is exterior to the Maltese archipelago would be landmass. Because if you've got a sizable landmass, if you've got a favorable climate, you would get a certain amount of surface water movement. So you would get the formation of springs, streams, and rivers that would be sort of draining the landscape towards the river estuary, which would be the coastal zone area. So that's one of the first points. And if you think of London as a settlement, Paris as a settlement, all these would have initially formed because of their proximity right on the bank of a river. The river would have provided the settlement with its necessary hydrology, but also with an ease for the transportation of goods and communication. So London would have been connected to the coastal area by means of the River Thames. The River Thames is navigable. So it's a multifaceted issue, basically. But then you would get geology that would come more into the fore when it comes to subsurface water availability. And in geology, we've got the term, which is a geotard. And a geotard would be a rock deposit that is not as permeable as others, and therefore it would hinder water percolation within, and therefore allowing for the formation of a subsurface aquifer, okay, which if being located at a favorable location close to the surface of the landscape, that might be tapped by past human occupants of a particular territory or area.
I mean, you mentioned London. I don't know whether the water in the Thames was ever potable, even in antiquity, maybe, but it doesn't look very potable now. And the difference between that and going to Scotland and walking on the moors in Yorkshire even, and seeing that crystal clear running water that you really could just dip your hand into and be very, feel very happy just, you know, sucking it up. Mm-hmm. What creates that kind of difference?
No, basically it's human land use. So if you've got agriculture taking place on the banks of the river, if you've got further settlements that are located further up the riverbed or upstream, that's a context where, yes, your water can start eventually become contaminated. During the medieval period, the water of the River Thames was certainly not drinkable. It was too contaminated to be able to use that for potable purposes, definitely.
Before we get to perhaps the Maltese context, could you give us some examples of ingenious ways that perhaps ancient societies have managed their hydrology or used their hydrological situations to their advantage?
Okay, so basically, strategies would differ to different regions, and I don't want to delve into much depth about that, but one thing that one can mention is the fact that one of the earliest known wars that has been recorded to around 4,500 years ago would have been fought in present-day Iraq, where the kingdom of Lagash would have actually diverted water from the river Tigris from going to the nearby kingdom of Umma. So basically speaking, we know that water was a reason for conflict. In past civilizations, it still is a measure of conflict for the current context, current political context, and with climate change, quite probably, it will be a renewed venue for conflict.
I was in Jordan in very early 2020, before lockdown, fortunately. I remember how annoyed the guide sounded when we would say, oh, well, gosh, the river looks very low, even though it was winter. And he'd say, well, you know, it's been diverted upstream to feed agriculture. Even the River Jordan, really, is a very small, I'm sure it was much wider in antiquity than it is now. And it creates a lot of annoyance and fear, I think, on the part of those who are being used. About Malta in prehistory, what solution? I mean, this is a Mediterranean climate, and I don't suppose it was that different, say, in 3,500 when Gigantea was being built than it is now. Long, hot summers and warm, wet winters. What were the solutions that were found for the issues of the day regarding hydrology?
So to start off with having a look at how the Maltese climate might have looked like in prehistory, studies are still ongoing, but the general idea, the general view is that we're dealing with some regional differences which might have happened throughout prehistory, but the climate must not have been substantially different from what it is today. It's still a Mediterranean climate. One of the main problems that Malta faces is limited rainfall, especially during the months of June, July, and August. July and August are basically two arid months. So we've got a drought season each year that lasts at least 2 months per year. And another problem that Malta faces is its geology because of its limited size. So basically speaking, we know that societies in prehistory, right until the 1850s, primarily depended on only one of Malta's aquifers, which is the Perged aquifer, which is the rainwater body that is filtering through the upper Corallina limestone and which is gathering above Blue Clay. So that was an easily accessible water source, and therefore most societies until the mid-1850s would have actually been tapping that water. It was only from the 1850 onwards that the mean sea level was actually systematically discovered and systematically utilized. So looking at prehistory, I would tend to actually classify Malta into two different portions. You've got prehistoric settlements and temples that would have been located in the central plains and in the southern plains of Malta, where the primary geology would be Globigerina limestone. So we're dealing with the Globigerina limestone landscapes here. And obviously, finding water within that landscape can be a tricky process. But looking at the temple distribution and looking at the geology, I very confidently state that and believe that prehistoric people had already detected subsurface water within the landscape, either accidentally, either coincidentally, or because they were already very good observers. Water is one of your principal needs. We need to realize that a liter of water weighs 1 kilogram. So water is quite difficult to carry. So you need to devise a way of either effectively being able to transport a water by means of a viaduct or by means of a piping system, or else have your settlement located right on top or very close to that water deposit. And so looking at, for instance, Tarshin temples, I'm sure that Tarshin, the site for Tarshin temples was identified. One of the reasons would have been that probably there's a substantial quantity of clay present within that Globigerina limestone deposit, and therefore it's acting as a geotard, allowing water to accumulate in deposits in very small quantities in areas around Tarshin temples. Professor Bolano had also conducted some research and some study on this fact, and I think that we both share a similar, if not an identical, conviction that prehistoric sites were actually conditioned by water availability.
The idea of gathering water, we are very used to now thinking about cisterns, but before we came on air, you were talking about population numbers and also about the difficulties of actually creating cisterns. We're talking about prehistory here.
Mm-hmm. So, yes, basically we need to realize that when we're dealing with prehistoric Malta, and I believe right until the end of the late medieval period, that is right until 1530, Malta's inhabitants would have not numbered more than around 17,000-18,000 inhabitants. Okay, so we're dealing with a relatively small number of people, which are nonetheless living in a climate that can be classified as being a semi-arid climate, and the parameters for a semi-arid climate would be a rainfall of roughly around 560 millimeters of rainfall a year, which is what we're currently getting on average, right down until around 300 millimeters of water per year. That would be the water range, the precipitation range for a semi-arid climate. And basically speaking, even though Malta is classified climate-wise as being a semi-arid, with 17,000, 18,000 inhabitants, there would have been enough water resources available on the island for the all the hydrological needs of these inhabitants. And by hydrological, watering for self-usage, watering for irrigation, and also watering for other agrarian uses.
I was in Gozo yesterday and walking down towards Mount Salforan and just looking around at the countryside. And there was quite a bit of water. Normally I go to that area in summer, where obviously it's dry as a bone. But what do you think that the people in antiquity would have, would they have utilized the kind of water that runs through our valleys? Not so much now, because obviously there's lots of pressure, but in that, at that time, there should have been a lot more water running in the valleys and probably all winter, really. Would they have utilized that, do you think?
And that's a very good point, actually, because what we're looking at currently in Malta would be a very much depleted water context. Throughout the whole of the Maltese archipelago, we've got numerous boreholes that are constantly pumping up water. It's not only the water services company that is pumping up water, but also private industries and private individuals. And probably the amount of water extracted by private individuals and industry actually is much, much larger than the amount of water that is being extracted by the water services company. So, yes, we're looking at a largely depleted water or hydrological context. And yes, in antiquity, there would have been much more surface water available. But it always depended in which part of Malta or in which part of Gozo you're actually located. For instance, I've just mentioned prehistoric temples located in Malta's Globigerina Plains. But if you're looking at prehistoric temples located, for instance, at Bahria, which are located and are built right above Upper Corala Limestone, those would have been constructed right above the Perched Aquifer. So water availability for that context would have been a much more simpler context. Water was available in a context that your temple would have been built quite close to a ridge, quite close to a cliff context. You would be looking at the geology. Blue clay is right beneath you, and therefore you can visually see the water spring that is yielding water probably all year round. So that's the varying context that I was trying to explain earlier.
You said that things started to change in the medieval period. Was it simply an increase in population? Was there greater pressure? Was there a certain modernization of agriculture coming into view? What gave rise to the changes? For example, you mentioned the aquifers became much more sophisticated than just using them as a spring.
So basically, first and foremost, I want to point out that change is relative in the sense that medieval change to our countryside context or what survives of it is easier to detect simply because of the fact that still survives. Much of the prehistoric landscape would have been wiped away with millennia of human-induced changes. So we're lucky in the sense that when it comes to the medieval period, it's a landscape that still somewhat survives. So it's better for us, it's easier for us to understand. Okay, but yes, my idea is that towards the end of the medieval period, which would have ended with 1530, with the coming of the Knights of St. John to Malta, was a better organized context than it might have been in the prehistoric period, simply because of the fact that there was better knowledge of dealing with aquifers and water bodies gathering above blue clay. There was probably the transference of knowledge and the transference of technology, which I suspect must have been coming from both Sicily and North Africa during this period. So there was a context where people were basically knowing where to look for water in an organized manner. They were, if it boils down to dealing with the Perched Aquifer, for instance, people were looking for ridges within the landscape they were looking for a particular type of geology, which is Imtar Famembe, which technically forms part of Upper Coralline Limestone. That would be the interface where the Upper Coralline Limestone deposit ends and where the blue clay deposit starts. So they would have realized that there would have been water collecting within the Imtar Famembe deposit. So all they needed to do was to actually excavate a linear tunnel, narrow tunnel, into the landscape in order to collect water, divert it, and divert it to wherever they needed in order to irrigate their landscape. And one of the magnificent things of medieval hydrology in both Malta, Sicily, and North Africa that still merits much, much more research would be the utilization of gravity in order to move around water without the need of machinery or any water lifting devices.
That's amazing how they did that. I've been able to visit with you one or two of these tunneled aquifers, and they really are a magnificent piece of early engineering, I suppose, early modern engineering. What about the documentation? I mean, historical documentation, obviously from the medieval period, would be a study in itself, I suppose.
Yes, definitely. And the starting point for my PhD thesis, which resulted in the publication of the Malta and Water book, basically was the fact that I knew that there were numerous water galleries, which are these water tunnels that I've explained beforehand, that were present within the Maltese landscape in North and Northwest Malta, and also parts of Gozo, which have a similar geology to the one I'm explaining. But we could never agree on a dating context for these water systems. The general idea was that many of these would have probably belonged to the Knights period. So what I did was to actually resort to a retrogressive analysis of the landscape. That is, I started looking at items within the landscape that were datable and securely datable to different periods and epochs, and trying to eliminate the items which therefore were datable and see what items still remain within that landscape. And I can say that by looking at British documentation for hydraulic engineering works that took place within the Maltese and Gozitan landscape, looking at Knights period documentation, I can safely state that a number of water systems that I actually mentioned in my Malt and Water book belong to the pre-Knights period, and therefore we're dealing with hydraulic engineering works that probably were inspired from similar hydraulic contexts that were taking place in Sicily, in places such as Palermo or Agrigento, or the southeast, which we mainly identify with the Ragusano, and that they would have been imported locally and actually utilized in order to increase the agricultural output of very carefully identified landscapes.
I've seen some of those diagrams. I've seen mostly the British ones, but they really are splendid. I mean, the British were, wonderful at engineering feats, and very, very good at recording. I've seen some of the diagrams of the waterworks where they utilized, I think, the aqueduct, Winyakor aqueduct, and put it to use underground in the area of Hamroom, for example. Very complex stuff.
Yes, it's complex stuff, but actually one of the eye-openers of my research, at least for me, was to actually realize that frequently think of the Knights as being able hydrologists. But my research actually made me appreciate more the hydrological expertise which was done by anonymous engineers in the pre-Knights period. And I'm stating this simply because of the fact that the Winyakort Aqueduct obviously dates to the Knights period. That's a fact. But the sources which the aqueduct is stepping into are very frequently pre-Knights engineering works, which would have actually already been present within the Maltese landscape. which were present in the agricultural territories that the knights inherited on coming over to Malta and assuming possession of Malta in 1530. And they would have been actually identified as being the primary springs that would be feeding the Knight Spirit Aqueduct. So there's a whole story.
The knights found a lot ready for them, so to speak.
Exactly. And it's water sources that primarily they were not at first hand aware of.
Various aspects to this. Unfortunately, we don't have much time. But there's the aspect of the agriculture and the importance those birched aquifers are still till today. They still use them. Farmers use them. Malta's best agricultural, best kept secret. And the desire for drinking water more with the increase in population obviously became more of an issue. Just quickly as we end the program, there's lots of things have been done to try and improve water situations all around the world, obviously in places where there's the space and the things like dams, draining of land, obviously one thinks of the Netherlands, water pumps. But there are perhaps some downsides to that, which are perhaps being seen now and also being seen perhaps because of climate change. What do you think?
The problem, as always, is diverting water from its natural location. And that has been happening for the past millennia. Let's take a local example to illustrate this. Why did Valletta necessitate an aqueduct? It's simply because of the fact that the new capital wasn't built directly above a purged aquifer. And that's the main problem. So the aqueduct was needed to divert water from a part of Malta where water was available to a part of Malta where water was not known to be available. And Imdina did not have that same context, did not have that same problem. It was built directly above the purged aquifer. So yes, diverting water in a much wider context would mean that you are depriving inhabitants from access to water that they would have previously had. So that's one of the main difficulties. And obviously, water deprivation would not only lead to human suffering, but it also would lead to the degradation of ecosystems, because ecology would be changing suddenly, and therefore ecological systems that could have coped with the amount of or quantities of water that were available within that landscape now can't, obviously. And one other thing that I want to mention that we didn't mention when it came to prehistoric Malta, one of the main limiting factors of water availability in prehistoric Malta was the fact that you've got some very minor aquifers found in Globigerina. Okay, so that was probably being tapped. But prehistoric people could never engage in a much wider scale in the construction of cisterns, because waterproofing mortar still had not been invented at that point. Probably waterproofing water was only available within the context of the central Mediterranean, and by central Mediterranean I mean Sicily, Malta, and so on, roughly around 400 or 500 BC. And that's when, therefore, a completely new idea on how to manage your water supply, okay, as from this point on, we basically start finding a dual water management system. You would be tapping water from the aquifer when that's available, and also tapping, collecting water, storing rainwater within man-made systems.
Thank you so much, Dr. Keith Bohajar, for talking to us today about water hydrology. I hope that our listeners will join me again next week, when we shall be tackling another important theme in the field of archaeology. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.